From Brennan to the Boca Chiel, from Lamy to La Push, and from the lordly Sawduck to lovely Duckabush. From Samish to Sammamish, Suquamish to Quilicene, the climate is so friendly, it's a land that's evergreen.
Hello, and welcome to the History of the Evergreen State podcast. I'm your host, John C., and thank you for joining me today for episode 116, The Unsolved Great Northern Train Murders. The Great Northern Passenger Train number 358 departed Seattle's King Street Station on Friday, the 20th of February 1914 at 4:35 p.m. on its way to Vancouver, British Columbia. At 7 p.m., the train stopped at Burlington in Skagit County to pick up and drop off passengers. Two men entered the smoking observation car and quickly took their seats. They were appropriately attired in suits, hats, and overcoats. The train left the station for Bellingham at around 7:15. The train accelerated as it moved toward Blanchard across the Skagit Valley. The two men entered the vestibule between the day coach and the smoking car at 7:30 p.m. and covered their faces with large white handkerchiefs. The first robber entered the coach through the back door while yelling, "Hands up!" and flashing a light from the car's ceiling. The front door was locked by the second bandit as he went up the aisle to it, blocking access from the dining car. There were three men seated in the chairs near the front door: Thomas F. Wadsworth, a conductor for the Canadian Pacific Railway; Harold R. Adkisson, who worked as a salesman for the Vancouver Tire and Rubber Company; and Robert L. Lee, a clerk for the Puget Sound Navy Yard over in Bremerton. Wadsworth instantly attacked the thief in an attempt to steal his gun and confront him. Rather quickly after that, Adkisson and Lee became involved in the conflict as well. During the struggle, the robber who was hiding in the back of the car moved down the aisle of the coach, shot out the ceiling lights, and then proceeded to shoot Wadsworth in the shoulder. The bullet entered his heart after passing through his body, more than likely killing him nearly instantly. The second robber was successful in shooting Adkisson through the left eye point blank with his weapon, causing the bullet to travel straight through Adkisson's head. Again, probably another instant death. After that, he fired five shots in the direction of Lee's back. His heart was struck by one of the bullets, killing him as well. The first robber returned to the back of the train car, where he calmed the terrified passengers by assuring them that it was only a joke, before demanding that they hand over all of their money as well as any possessions that could be of value. Some of the passengers managed to hide some of their belongings, but the majority of them flung their wallets and purses out of the window so at the least the thieves wouldn't get them. Fully cooperating with the robbers' demands, the others gave them what they had. The second thief began making his way down the corridor while gathering the stolen goods along the way. Conductor Charles S. Waldron was in the dining car at the time when he heard the distinct sound of gunfire. In response, he pulled the emergency brake cable to stop the train. When the train came to an unexpected halt near the Sammish Interurban Station, some 10 miles south of Bellingham, the thieves were in the process of gathering the loot and cramming it into their coat pockets. They quickly jumped from the platform and promptly rushed off into the night before exiting the train by the front vestibule. It was estimated that the passengers had lost close to $100. Two males were seen jumping off the day coach and running along the right side of the train towards the engine tender by four individuals who were waiting at the Sammish Interurban stop. When the guys started to climb onto the tender, they were scared away when the engineer, George C. Wright, approached with a flashlight and shone it back along the train. This caused the bandits to flee. The men had hidden themselves below the train, sprinted some 40 feet, and then dove beneath the wooden platform in front of the Pearl Oyster Company. They remained there until the train arrived in Bellingham after leaving. When the conductor found out that the bandits had gotten away, he ordered the engineer to bring the train into Bellingham, where it was greeted at the Great Northern Station by the Whatcom County Coroner, Dr. Henry Thompson, and three deputy sheriffs. Dr. Thompson assumed command of the situation, doing an autopsy on the deceased where they had been found, as well as collecting the names and contact information of any witnesses. The bodies of the three murdered men were then transported to the Anders G. Wickman Undertaking Parlor located in Bellingham at 1146 Elk Street, which is now known as State Street. The sheriffs of Whatcom County, Lewis A. Thomas, and Skagit County, Edwin Wells, joined forces in order to find the robbers. Between Burlington and Bellingham, heavily armored posses were dispatched to conduct security checks at all of the trails, roads, and crossroads, as well as any train tracks. A group of law enforcement officers were dispatched on a specialized train in the direction of Samish in order to investigate the murder site and look for the perpetrators. They were able to find tracks that led from a culvert underneath the Pearl Oyster Company dock, north along the Samish Bay tide flats, and eventually into Chuckanut Bay, which was where the robbers could have hidden a boat. As soon as it was determined that the men might easily flee the area by boat to either the San Juan Islands or further north to Canada, police officers were dispatched from Bellingham in speedy motor launches in order to conduct a patrol of the surrounding area. The search for the three suspects proceeded all throughout the night without any success. On Saturday, the 21st of February, 1914, the authorities in Western Washington and British Columbia set up a dragnet that covered the two jurisdictions. A significant number of homeless people and formerly incarcerated individuals were taken into custody and questioned by the police. In their search for suspicious individuals, armed men halted all of the automobiles and trains that were passing through the area. A pack of bloodhounds from the Washington State Reformatory in Monroe was sent in to assist with the search when posses began searching the woods around Samish that stretched for miles. Officers from the Bellingham Police Department searched the whole shoreline from Blanchard to Bellingham, investigating hobo camps and shacks along the way in their search for hiding places and any possible leads they might uncover. They heard about a weird watercraft from a local fisherman who lived in the area, and he told them that it entered Chuckanut Bay around 8 p.m. the night before, and it had vanished by the following morning. Because the authorities were certain that the robbers had gotten away in a boat, they stopped looking for them on land and instead increased the number of motor launches that searched the San Juan Islands and patrolled the waters south of the international boundary line. It was only by coincidence, but on Saturday night, the interurban train number 59, owned by Puget Sound Electric Company, was stopped by three masked men carrying handguns at the Southside Station, which is located 6 miles from Seattle. The train was headed south on its way to Tacoma. While one robber held his gun to the members of the crew, the other robbers ordered a young man named Norris King, who was only 18 years old at the time, still just a kid and probably absolutely terrified, ordered him to take his hat into the forward carriage and collect money from the passengers. After that, they looted the train personnel as well as the passengers who were riding in the rear coach. These robbers made their getaway with an estimated $400. The newspapers hypothesized that the robberies that occurred on the interurban and the Great Northern passenger train were connected in some way. However, the authorities rapidly debunked this hypothesis. 2 days were spent searching South King County by sheriff's posses, but the interurban criminals managed to elude capture the entire time. The owner of the Great Northern Railway, James J. Hill, delegated the investigation in Bellingham to be directed by Chief Special Agent Al G. Ray of the Great Northern Railway's headquarters in St. Paul, Minnesota, as well as Assistant Special Agents James J. Davis, Charles McShane, and James A. Dundon, all of whom came from their respective locations in Seattle, Chicago, and Columbus, Ohio. In order to apprehend the evaders, Mr. Hill gave the orders to spare no expense and to make no concessions in the search for them. In order to take part in the manhunt and to investigate the leads, he sent 150 train investigators and Pinkerton agents to the Northwest. On Sunday, the 22nd of February, 1914, Chief Ray announced that a detective would be present at all times to receive intelligence at the center of operations that he had established in the Leopold Hotel in Bellingham, which was then located at 1218 Dock Street and is currently located at 1224 Cornwall Avenue. The Great Northern Railway dispersed thousands of handbills advertising a reward of $30,000 for the capture of the killers, regardless of whether they were found dead or alive. On the morning of Tuesday, the 24th of February, 1914, the exhaustive search for the robbers was called off. Every person who had been detained in connection with the crime was questioned and then let go after being cleared. Over the course of the following few days, armed vigilantes continued to patrol the area in the hopes of apprehending the murderers and claiming the prize money. The agents who were stationed at the Leopold Hotel were fielding at least 20 telephone calls each day from all across the Pacific Northwest with information on individuals and activities that appeared to be suspicious. The majority of the Great Northern Railway investigators who were operating in the area were transferred to investigate leads in other regions of Washington and British Columbia. Thus, it was up to the county sheriffs to investigate the leads that were found locally. Every correctional facility in the Northwest, including those just outside of the direct region, supplied images of newly released inmates to Special Agent Davis at the Leopold Hotel. When the pictures were provided to the witnesses, none of them were able to identify the robbers in the photos. The investigation proceeded in a fruitless manner for quite a long time and was pretty much stone cold from the get-go. Chief Special Agent Ray made the announcement on Friday the 20th of March 1914 that they would be leaving Bellingham to attend to their usual tasks. However, an agent would remain at the Leopold Hotel for a few weeks to explore any fresh leads. According to him, railroad detectives had two suspects under surveillance in Canada and were in the midst of gathering evidence to substantiate their claims. An informant in a Victoria, BC hospital, feeling he was about to die from a gunshot wound in the abdominal area, identified George Ball and Harry Matthews as the train robbers. Both George Ball and Harry Matthews had previously served time in prison and were drug users. According to Chief Ray, witnesses to the heist had a strong suspicion that mug pictures of Georgie Ball, aged 25, and Harry Matthews, aged 26, belonged to the perpetrators of this heinous crime. According to the allegations made by Chief Special Agent Ray, Ball and Matthews purchased two firearms from a pawn shop in Seattle on Wednesday, the 18th of February, 1914. The following day, Thursday, the 19th of February, they took a train to travel to Bellingham. They went to two different pharmacies in the area and made purchases of morphine that was suitable for medical use. After that, they hung out in a billiard hall for a while and played multiple rounds of pool. The druggists and the owner of the billiard hall selected mugshots of Ball and Matthews from a group of 50 different images of former inmates. On the day of the robbery, which took place on Friday the 20th of February 1914, Ball and Matthews rode an interurban train operated by the Pacific Northwest Traction Company to Mount Vernon. There, they visited numerous local pharmacy stores and bought morphine, consumed ice cream, and drank a couple glasses of Coca-Cola. They traveled 3 miles on foot to reach Burlington in the late afternoon, where they boarded Great Northern Passenger Train No. 358, where they later committed 3 murders and multiple robberies against the day coach passengers. After getting off the train, the men went their separate ways. Matthews disappeared from view before Ball made it to Bellingham. Coincidentally, a train investigator from Seattle said that the morning following the crime, he recognized George Ball while he was walking around the streets of Bellingham. After Ball boarded the Great Northern Passenger Train heading north into Canada, the investigator continued to pursue him. Both of them got off the train in New Westminster, British Columbia, where they both found work at a logging camp. In the hope that Ball would eventually join up with Matthews, 6 additional railroad detectives joined the surveillance operation. They followed Ball across the lower region of British Columbia and then went to Calgary in Alberta over the course of the subsequent weeks. When word got out that arrest warrants had been issued for the men who were suspected of robbing the train, Ball began behaving in a very suspicious manner, and the investigators became concerned that their surveillance operation had been compromised. On the evening of Thursday, the 26th of March, 1914, members of the Calgary Police Department detained Bell as he was leaving a telegraph office. The railroad investigators hypothesized that Ball, upon discovering that Matthews was being watched, telegraphed a warning for him to stay away. 2 investigators from the GNR arrived in Vancouver, British Columbia on Saturday, the 28th of March, 1914, with their prisoner George Ball in tow. There, they spoke with Sheriff Edwin Wells, who informed them that a warrant for Ball's arrest had been issued by Judge Egbert Crookston of the Skagit County Superior Court. Following his denial of any involvement in the crime, Ball then waived extradition to the United States by stating he had a good alibi for the day the train was robbed and that the investigators simply had the wrong guy. In Skagit County Superior Court on the first Wednesday of April 1914, Chief Prosecutor Charles D. Beagle filed charges against George E. Ball for the robbery of a train and the first-degree murder of 3 people. However, Prosecutor Beagle and Sheriff Wells were not convinced that they had charged the correct individual, so they traveled to British Columbia on 2 separate occasions in order to look into Ball's alibi. They went back to Mount Vernon having reached the conclusion that the railroad investigators had detained the wrong man. Great Northern Railway officials persevered in prosecuting Ball for the crime, even after it was brought to their attention that the investigator had made multiple mistakes. Beagle footed the bill to fly 3 witnesses all the way in from Port Coquitlam, British Columbia, to Mount Vernon in order to testify in support of Ball's case. At the arraignment that took place on Friday, the 10th of April, 1914, Ball pleaded not guilty to the charges that were brought against him by Judge Crookston. During the preliminary hearing, the prosecution presented many witnesses who stated that they believed they recognized Ball as one of the bandits. However, none of these witnesses were willing to swear to their identification. According to Ball, there had been an obvious case of mistaken identity here. He recognized Matthews in a picture as Harry McAvoy, a man he had met a few months earlier in Vancouver, British Columbia, but who he hadn't seen since then. Beagle's defense attorney John F. Doerr introduced Beagle's three witnesses to prove his alibi after Ball testified that he was with friends in Port Coquitlam on the day of the heist, the 20th of February 1914. After the completion of the hearing, Judge Crookston ordered that the case be transferred to the Superior Court for further proceedings. To add even more confusion to the entire situation, Prosecutor Beagle was responsible for L.P. Johnson's arrest on the 18th of April, 1914. L.P. Johnson, one of the most crucial identification witnesses for the state, was arrested for the charge of first-degree perjury. At the preliminary hearing, Johnson had testified that he knew Ball and had seen him drinking at the Pioneer Saloon in Cedro Woolley on the 21st of February, 1914, the day after the robbery. However, the saloon's liquor license had expired, and as a result, it was closed from the 15th to the 24th of February. On the 15th of February, 1914, Ball was registered at a motel in Kamloops, British Columbia. Johnson pled not guilty, and the date of his trial was set for the 15th of June, 1914. As a result of Beagle's disagreements with the executives of the Great Northern Railway regarding the prosecution of Ball, Beagle requested that the Attorney General of Washington State, William V. Tanner, conduct an independent examination into Ball's alibi. Beagle provided Tanner with a comprehensive report that detailed Ball's movements beginning 1 week prior to the crime and continuing for 3 weeks after it. The report included names, places, interviews, and a hotel register that proved Ball was in Canada on the day of the heist. He also found out that the source of Victoria was a guy who had initially fingered Ball as one of the bandits did it out of spite over a woman. Beagle expressed his concerns to Tanner about the possibility of a plot involving railroad investigators to frame Ball for the crime in order to receive the $30,000 reward. Beagle told Tanner that he was quite worried about the so-called plot. The Burns Detective Agency was tasked with conducting the investigation after being hired by Assistant Attorney General Scott Z. Henderson. They revealed their findings a few weeks later, stating that Beagle's report was correct. Ball's alibi was entirely valid. On the 15th of June, 1914, in Skagit County, Superior Court Judge Jesse P. Hauser granted a motion by prosecuting attorney Beagle to have the case against Georgie Ball dropped. Beagle argued that the evidence presented by the state was insufficient to secure a conviction. Frederick V. Brown, the attorney for the Great Northern Railway, did not contest the application, and it was granted. Judge Hauser issued an order requiring that Ball serve as a material witness while being detained in the Mount Vernon jail until the conclusion of L.P. Johnson's trial for perjury in the first degree, which was to begin the same day. The trial came to a close at 4 in the afternoon on the 17th of June, 1914. After almost 2 hours of deliberation, the jury decided that Johnson was not guilty of the crime, and as a result, he and Ball were both freed from detention that same day. The Great Northern Railway investigators did not fare any better in their quest for Harry Matthews, who was suspected of being Ball's companion. A former felon by the name of Harry Matthews was taken into custody by the Seattle Police Department shortly after the heist. However, he was let go after being questioned by Captain Charles Tennant. On the 28th of March 1914, Special Agent Davis tracked down Matthews and found him at the Steilacoom Institution known as the Western Washington State Hospital. On the basis of his father's petition, the Seattle District Court ordered him to be committed to the mental institution 10 days prior. Matthews' father provided evidence to support his alibi, which stated that he had been residing in Seattle with his parents for the past 18 months. An image of George Blair, who he had seen a few months earlier in Vancouver, British Columbia, was recognized by him as being Ball in the photo. In the same month of March 1914, police in Vancouver, British Columbia, arrested a man called Harry Matthews once again in connection with the bank heist in the area, but he turned out to be the wrong culprit. Great Northern Railway officials stated on the 14th of April that fugitive Harry Matthews had been murdered in a shootout with railroad detectives near Lemon, South Dakota. However, just 2 days later, the man was identified as James W. Weininger, an outlaw from Butte, Montana. Investigators with the Great Northern Railway broadened their search for the two homicidal bandits to encompass all of North America, but the case would never be solved, and it most likely never will be. It's a never-ending, evergreen state whodunit. If you're enjoying the show, please leave a 5-star review, and don't forget to subscribe so that you never miss a new episode. Doing so really helps the show to grow and to expand to a new audience, so any help that you can give in that regard will be greatly appreciated. Sources for this episode include the Seattle Times, the Bellingham Herald, the Seattle Post-Intelligencer, Legends of America, DarkCornersOfHistory.com, AtlasObscura.com, the Tacoma News Tribune, and the Tacoma Times Archives at the Library of Congress. Thank you for listening to episode 116, The Unsolved Great Northern Train Murders. Episode 117 will be released next week and will focus on a dangerous collision between the famed USS Arizona and the small fishing vessel Umatilla. A special thanks goes out to Al Hirsch for providing the music for the podcast. If you have any questions about the show, please contact historyoftheevergreenstatepod@gmail.com. Thank you for listening to another episode of the History of the Evergreen State podcast. And until next time, I'm your host, John C.
There's peace on the Skokomish, on the Queets and on the Ho. There's calm on the Nisqually, born of ageless ice and snow. A land that nature loves so much, she stays the whole year round. I trade a royal palace for a shack on Puget Sound. There's Chimicum and Stillicum, where spouts the gooey duck, the singing Stillaguamish and the swirling Skookumchuck, and Moclips and Copalis, where the razor clams abound. A little bit of heaven is a shack on Puget Sound. A little bit of heaven is a shack on Puget Sound.